Senate is looking at a variety of ways to get the price of gas down.
But partisanship is standing in the way.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for checking out the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Wednesday, May 18th.
Coming up, we'll find out what's causing the frenzy that's going on this week in the corporate bond market.
If or when the IMF chief goes, who's going to replace him?
And one man's fortune isn't stopping him from acting like he's out of money. All that coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
The Senate is expected to vote today on a Republican proposal to increase domestic oil drilling, but the chances of passage look about as good as yesterday's vote on taking away tax breaks for big oil companies. That vote failed.
Now, both proposals are Washington's way of responding to high gas prices. And now, as Marketplace Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports, some senators are calling for an investigation into potential price fixing by the nation's oil refiners.
The group of Democrats say the refineries' take from each gallon of gasoline has nearly doubled since January.
We don't know if this is a smoking gun, but it sure requires a close look.
New York's Charles Schumer and Missouri's Claire McCaskill say refiners are only running at 80% capacity, and McCaskill wonders whether they're deliberately trimming supply to increase the price.
There is a 20% capacity they're not using. Obviously, I think for most consumers in America would go, why not?
The American Petroleum Institute's John Felmy says the capacity cutback is due to spring maintenance and flood prevention. As for the gusher of earnings,
it's important to know that at the very beginning of the year, refiners were losing money. So talking about big percentage increases off of a very small number is simply bogus.
Still, senators want the Federal Trade Commission to check it out. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
A consulting firm says U.S. auto sales are likely to rebound to pre-recession levels in 2 years. The news comes as GM says it'll invest more than $100 million at a couple of plants in Michigan.
But a recent study says car making has changed dramatically in the Midwest, even before the recession hit. Jerry Conover is director of the Indiana Business Research Center at the Kelley School of Business, which, full disclosure now, is one of this program's underwriters. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Talk about your study and the future of the auto industry in the Midwest particularly.
Over the past decade, more than half of the jobs in the auto sector in the Midwest disappeared, and that was even before the recession. So we looked at things like changes in vehicle technology, you know, advanced powertrains, lightweight materials, and the nature of these changes, we determined, leads to a shift in the kinds of jobs that are available now and are likely to be available in the future for workers in the auto sector. A lot of the jobs going down the road are going to need more advanced training than was typical in the past.
I know historically a lot of people went from high school into the auto sector, and this was a step into the middle class for a lot of these workers. But now, as you say, with more education and more skills necessary, has that path, do you think, disappeared?
I think the fairly easy path of completing high school and going right into a factory job with high pay and strong benefits has pretty much faded from the landscape. There aren't many of those opportunities left.
The report says this is a reality check for the regional economy. What do you mean by that?
The three states that collaborated on this project were Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. About half of all the nation's production in the automobile industry is concentrated in these three states. And as a result, the automotive sector really pushes the region up or down with the fate of the industry. So we understand that the industry is changing. There will likely not be anywhere close to the number of jobs in the future as there have been in the past. And that's what we set out to try to understand more.
Jerry Conover from Indiana University. Jerry, thank you.
You're welcome, Steve.
Now let's get to the corporate borrowing bonanza that's going on. Big companies are loading up on debt this week because of extremely low interest rates. But interest rates have been low for a while, so why are companies borrowing so much now? David Kelly is Chief Market Strategist at J.P. Morgan Funds, and he's with us this morning from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why this borrowing bonanza this week?
Well, I think there are two things. I think, first of all, corporations actually feel a little bit better than consumers right now because corporate profits have been soaring. And in fact, corporate profits are almost back to where they were before the last recession started. So I think that helps. But the other thing is that corporations worry that the Federal Reserve is going to eventually begin raising interest rates. At the end of June, they're going to stop buying treasury bonds in the way they have been buying them. And that could push interest rates higher. And so they just don't want to miss out on the opportunity. They'd be kicking themselves if rates were much higher later on. And they have to borrow at higher rates next year.
And we saw this morning that mortgage rates are also dropping, just like corporate borrowing rates. Why aren't people going out to buy homes in the same way?
Yeah, it's such a great time to buy a house right now with prices down and mortgage rates, as you say, at extremely low levels. But one of the things that's really hurting the consumer side or the household side here is that people lost so much home equity. I mean, in order to move up in house, you have to put some money down, and now you have to put much more money down than a few years ago.
Right.
And the problem is a lot of people are underwater. They don't have more equity to put into buying more houses or more expensive houses, and that's really clogging up the whole housing market. I think that's one of the key reasons why housing is so subdued, even though corporate borrowing is moving up.
David Kelly, Chief Market Strategist with J.P. Morgan Funds, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
The world's largest maker of farm equipment said this morning its profits jumped 65% last quarter. Analysts say Deere & Company is benefiting from high food prices, which are giving farmers some extra cash to invest in equipment.
Profit at Staples rose 5%, but the results were not as good as expected, and the office supply chain cut its full-year earnings guidance. One of Alabama's biggest insurers, Alpha, reportedly will stop writing new policies on homes older than 10 years old. Homes, the insurance company says, have a higher damage risk during tornadoes.
We've got more numbers from Wall Street, the ones that go up and down, at our website, marketplace.org.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
Now the Marketplace Global Perspective. There are reports today that Dominique Strauss-Kahn is facing growing pressure to step down from the International Monetary Fund. The IMF chief is in jail in New York, accused of attempted rape.
Now, last night, U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner said Strauss-Kahn should go. But who's going to replace him? Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us now to talk about it. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Steve.
All right, so it seems clear the IMF is going to have a new leader soon. Will Strauss-Kahn's departure make much of a difference?
Potentially a huge difference. I mean, he's immensely powerful, capable, and he strongly supported the bailout plan in Europe, pouring billions of dollars of loans into countries like Greece. But there's a growing perception this isn't working. There may need to be a different approach, including perhaps some of these governments defaulting. It would be very messy, but it is a possibility now if, as expected, Strauss-Kahn leaves the top job and IMF policy changes.
So what do we know, Stephen, about a likely successor then?
Well, there's been talk of the IMF leadership switching outside Europe for the first time, going perhaps to China or Brazil. That possibly could mean a difference in the bailout plan. But the jockeying and horse trading is going on. It's underway. And what I'm hearing is that one of the likeliest successors could be the French finance minister, Christine Lagarde. The Europeans like her. The Americans like her, too. The argument is she could step in for the remaining 2 years of Strauss-Kahn's tenure. If that happens, IMF policy probably won't change and the bailouts will continue.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
It's voting day in cities all across South Africa, what's being called a big test for the ruling African National Congress Party. Once loyal supporters say the party that ended white minority rule years ago isn't doing enough for the poor these days. From Johannesburg, the BBC's Karen Allen reports.
The ANC is still the dominant political force in a country where nearly 80% of the population defines itself as black. And elections in South Africa are still largely determined by race. But now the main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, is hoping to win over towns and cities currently run by the ANC. The campaigning has focused not on race, but on the ruling party's ability to deliver cheap housing, water, and even public toilets in some of the poorest areas. Lerato Mafokeng is a resident of Ficksburg in the Free State.
We need a house.
We need a house because we are five living in a small house. We don't have any privacy.
The ANC's own supporters may be among its biggest critics, but what is far from clear is whether they'll transfer their loyalties to the opposition or abstain from voting altogether. In Johannesburg, I'm the BBC's Karen Allen for Marketplace.
A global travel and tourism summit is going on today in Las Vegas, and a big concern at the gathering is just how difficult it is for overseas tourists to get a visa to visit the United States. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
The question is whether the U.S. should make it easier for foreign tourists to get visas to come here. Right now, the U.S. requires a face-to-face interview, and at the American Embassy in Beijing, there are only 24 windows for visa processing. Roger Dow of the U.S. Travel Association says that's crazy.
So that's the equivalent of having one cashier at Costco over the holidays. You'd never do that.
Dow wants the Obama administration to streamline the process, increase visa fees, and use the money to hire more embassy staff, and use video conferencing for visa interviews. Rossi Rollincutter heads the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority. He says the growing middle classes in China and Brazil have money.
Travel is one way of spending their discretionary dollars. And so we need to be ready for that as a country to accept those new potential visitors.
Roland Cotter says it'll also become harder for Vegas to attract big conventions if the visa process isn't smoothed out. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Leroy Fick won $2 million in the Michigan lottery nearly a year ago, Jeremy. But that's not stopping him from using his food stamps at the grocery store.
What?
Yes. Fick tells a local TV station in Michigan that he still swipes his electronic food stamp debit card because the State Department of Human Services told him he could.
Wow.
And in case your outrage meter has reached the red zone, Fick says you can't make him feel bad about it either.
You know, he does make me feel a little bad about it, although...
No, but are you making
him feel
worse
bad? I feel worse about the fact that I haven't won $2 million in the lottery.
It'd be nice if everyone could win a little money, especially the people who need it. Foodies and deli owners will gather tomorrow in San Francisco to discuss the future of the old-school Jewish-style deli. Rising food and labor costs are making it harder for traditional delicatessens to stay afloat. Deb Monroe reports now on how some are trying to adapt.
It's almost lunchtime, and Saul's Deli in Berkeley is getting ready to serve its main attraction, the traditional pastrami sandwich.
The pastrami that we serve comes from a naval brisket.
Saul's co-owner, Peter Levitt, says this cut comes from a special section of beef now in huge demand to make processed meats like hot dogs, and that's doubled the price over the last 10 years. No surprise, a 12-ounce pastrami sandwich now costs $20, a turnoff for many customers.
There's no way to build a sandwich for $15 with 8, 9, or 10 ounces of meat in it and make a claim that you've used good meat.
5 years ago, Saul's Deli cut its standard pastrami sandwich to 6 ounces for $11.75. Customers who want more pastrami now face a sliding scale. Saul's has gone the way of the airlines, charging extra for more.
About 10% of our customers will add 1, 2, 3, or 4 ounces of meat to that.
But even with the smaller sandwich, Saul's is not recouping the cost of the meat.
People come in for the pastrami, but we absolutely need them to order a latke before, a potato dish. We need to have soup with a dumpling in it.
Levitt says it's all the other stuff on the menu that makes it possible to stay in business.
Then they need to get a dessert, and they need to wash the whole thing down with a few beers. And then we're all happy.
While Saul's Deli has shrunk its sandwiches, across the bay in San Francisco, Y-Sun's Deli has shrunk its menu to about 8 items. Co-owner Leo Beckerman says this keeps inventory costs down.
We're trying to keep our menu small and very much built out of products that we make ourselves. So, for example, we cure and smoke our own meat. We bake our own bread.
Y-Sun's charges $12 for a pastrami with a side and pickles. Retiree Judith Franklin didn't bat an eye.
For a good deli fix, I'm willing to pay.
Some customers, at least, are willing to accept quality over quantity, proving there may be a future for a leaner, meaner pastrami. In San Francisco, this is Deb Monroe for Marketplace.
And from pastrami to pickles, Steve, today is the 20th annual pickle eating contest at the Carnegie Deli in New York. 10 contestants will try to chow down on as many pickles as they can in a 5-minute window. I don't know how many you can eat in a 5-minute window, but the record currently stands at 3.8 pounds, consumed.
Oh.
I know. And, you know, no wonder Mayor Bloomberg is trying to cut down on the salt intake of the residents. But the head of the pickle company that sponsors the contest says it is absolutely nauseating to watch.
Even the pickle company guy says it's nauseating. That's not good, man, when the pickle company guy is nauseating. Wow.
Well, in Los Angeles and maybe heading out to get a pastrami sandwich and a pickle.
Ooh, that
this
sounds good, doesn't it?
I am Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Maybe an egg cream to go along with it, huh? This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.